For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh, host of In the Moment. Here is your arts and entertainment update. South Dakota has a new advocate for poetry. Christine Stewart begins her four-year term as South Dakota State Poet Laureate on July 1, 2019. Stewart hopes to invite people to write, but specifically to write about South Dakota. Outgoing Poet Laureate Leanne Rorapaw joined Christine Stewart on In the Moment to talk about poetry, place, and why the world of words matters so deeply. Leanne, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Christine, thanks, and welcome back to both of you.
Thanks.
We're going to look at some of your work and hopefully press you to do some reading for us. And Leanne, let's start with you and this latest collection, Tsunami versus the Fukushima 50. Tell us a little bit about the idea and how you started working on this particular book.
Well, I was very haunted by the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami, which in itself was devastatingly destructive, but then led to the subsequent Fukushima Daiichi reactor meltdown. And it just seemed like such an awful thing to happen to, you know, a country who'd already had, you know, terrible experiences with radiation following the dropping of the atomic bombs at the end of World War II. And so I was just really struck by that. And I decided that I wanted to find a way to write about it, to, you know, commemorate and honor the experience and the victims, because of something that disappeared really so quickly from the news cycle, yet it is still ongoing, because it's 2019 now, and only now this year have people been, who have become part of the nuclear diaspora, been slowly allowed to return to some of their homes in the no-go zone. Of course, there are questions about, you know, the cleanup, the level of contamination. There have been increased cases of thyroid cancer in children. So, you know, there's an environmental or eco-critical legacy that's ongoing as well. And so I wanted to focus attention on that. What I decided to do was I was inspired by the Godzilla movies and comics, which were very much an environmental response to the dropping of the atomic bombs. So there were mutant monsters rising on Monster Island in Japan. So that was one inspiration. And then I was also inspired by superheroes from comic books who frequently gain their superpowers through accidents involving radioactivity. So those became some of the tropes that I threaded in. I created a supervillainess named Tsunami, who was created by the trauma of the fault line in the ocean floor, very much like the way that X-Men's Magneto was created through the trauma of the Holocaust. And so it allowed me to explore gender, female rage, environmental questions, as well as honor, you know, the survivors and the deceased from the disaster.
And you must have known fairly early on what you had your arms around, that you're going to have to spend a lot of time with these people, with these voices, yeah, with this topic. How do you sort of care for yourself in a way, separate yourself, but yet enter the space so you can really have the full empathy that you need, but yet not be damaged in some way,
yeah,
not to compare your damage to, mm-hmm, what those people are going through and have gone, mm-hmm, through, but it's a real question, don't you think?
It is intense. I mean, I think that writing or poetry in particular is an act of, you know, radical empathy or compassion. And when you immerse yourself in some of these events, there's an intensity, an emotional intensity to that. But I think there's a poem by Kathy Song, who grew up in Hawaii, who talked about hearing a widower play the shakuhachi flute at night, and then he would cry she could hear him crying in the house next door through the open windows for his dead wife. And then the closing line of it, that she was like a shell on the beach beach that had like been washed clean but was still safe. And so the intensity of the ocean kind of sweeping over the shell, but there was also a kind of catharsis or safety to being able to experience it in the remove. Hmm.
Will you read from this book for us? I've picked out a few poems that I'm hoping we might start with. And the first one, if you're following along at home, is on page 8. And I'll let you set it up and introduce
it. Okay. This is called Animal Portents Foretell the Rise of Tsunami. And so if there's a supervillainess headed your way, perhaps there should be portents to herald her arrival. And these are all, interestingly, things that animals do biologically when disaster or extreme weather, like earthquakes or tornadoes, are coming. So these are all actual signs that you can read in the natural world. There is a snippet in Japanese, and that's an homage to a woman named Miki Endo, who worked at the disaster prevention office in Minami Soma. And she stayed on the loudspeaker and told people to seek higher ground and run away. And many people said that they hadn't gone to a high enough ground, and that hearing her say that saved their lives. But she lost her life. She was office was eventually swept away in the tsunami. Animal portents foretell the rise of tsunami. When elephants kneel, pressing their trunks down to the ground like seismic antenna. When mole rats head drum adumbrations, listen for predictions, auger jawbones snugged to tunnel walls. When cats spill from windows, slip through open doors, some welder's torch sizzle, fizzing the tips of their whiskers. When insect swarms clot the shore in a frantic, tangled macrame, and hippopotamuses bellow a chorus of mournful cellos. When snakes awaken from hibernation, curlicuing up from their dens like bolts come unscrewed, their frozen bodies a semiology of hieroglyphs in the snow. Takadai ni tatsu, takadai ni tatsu, takadai ni tatsu, hayaku nigeru. When double helixes spun by skeins of flying sparrows unravel, when centipedes appear in rippling synchronicities, when colonies of toads erupt like burst popcorn from pond's silver foil, when fish come unschooled, when bees abandon their queens, flee their honey, when silky clusters of bats lift in smoky volcanic furies as if rising from a city ravished in flame.
And I'm hoping we can just jump to the next page, and if you would read Radioactive Man for us.
Radioactive Man is based on, most of my dramatic monologues are in the voices of fictional characters, but this is one of the characters that is close to real life. There were two men who stayed behind in the no-go zone despite the radioactivity to care for the animals, and this is one of them. So his comic book alter ego is Radioactive Man. The papers started calling me Radioactive Man after tests from the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency revealed the highest radiation levels in anyone they'd ever screened. I guess I'm the champion, I joke, to reporters who come for interviews like visitors from another planet. Bulky and brightly awkward in white hazmat suits, they look like mourners at a Buddhist funeral. And so I light a cigarette to dangle from the corner of my lip and grin. Even 8 miles away in Tomioka, the sound of reactor 4 exploding was completely unmistakable. So I took my elderly parents south to my aunt in Iwaki, who refused to even open her door to us because she said we were contaminated. Then we tried a temporary shelter, but it was full, so we came home again to the no-go zone. And when other relatives agreed to take in my parents, I stayed behind to care for the abandoned animals. I've seen many terrible things, cages filled with withered songbirds, horses left to starve in their stalls, an abandoned puppy that grew too big for the chain around its neck. I rescue as many as I can. The dog trapped inside a barn for months, who survived by eating the dead flesh of starved cattle. Or the feral ostrich, so vicious the police who border patrol the nuclear exclusion zone, armed with Geiger counters, nicknamed her the boss. All over Tomioka, the animals recognize the sound of my truck and come running to meet me when I make my daily rounds. Many come to stay with me at my family's old rice farm, living without water or electricity in the ruins of the town where I was born is sometimes very lonely. I wait for cancer or leukemia, and joke to the boss about becoming a superhero through a radioactive ostrich bite. Sometimes I think of visiting my two kids who live with my ex-wife in Tokyo, but then I remind myself of the invisible dust coated in cesium particles that's in my clothes, my hair, my skin. I remember I can see my future in the sick animals I care for. In the American Watchmen comics, Dr. Manhattan was once tricked into believing he'd given everyone he ever loved cancer through exposure to his radioactive body. Just the thought of this undid him, made him feel so solitary and blue, he left the Earth behind for eons to brood in exile on the moon.
Thank you. Christine Stewart, we have two books that we're hoping to press you to read from today, Blue Words Greening and Untrust. And I'd like to start with Blue Words Greening, because you alluded to this earlier in some of the themes that ended up in this particular collection. Hoping you would read Boy at Rest. Do you want to set that up for us at all?
Sure. It is an ekphrastic piece, meaning it was inspired in part by a piece of art, Girl at Rest. And it's also based on my son's epilepsy syndrome, which is called Landau-Kleffner syndrome. And this form of epilepsy acted like a tamper on his ability to learn for many years, and it also regressed his ability to use language and understand language. So you get a description of that in this poem. Boy at Rest, with an epigraph from Carolyn Forché's The Angel of History. While sleeping, the child vanishes from his life. In Girl at Rest, I saw only a hazy silhouette of a child's body, the navy blue flame of her arms, head, and a bit of torso. And I read the artist's choice of ochre and light gray, shades shifting only slightly, to convey background and skin with wonder. The colors nearly vanish the child. When I study my son asleep, it's in full dimension, eyelids threaded with a blue vein, a freckle emerging on the outline of his lip. There's no facial stress, but I don't need to guess. Rest is an illusion, not a feature of a brain besought by seizures. By day, they complicate the spelling of C-A-T, blur the way sounds rolling into each other infuse meaning. When sound does get through the screen of spells, a word may fail to find its place on his tongue. The seizures also erase memories of lunchtime pizza, gym class tag, the answer to what's your last name, the need to look both ways before crossing the parking lot outside the store. On the monitor, I hear him speak, a midnight phrase thrown from deep sleep, and I wonder what sounds emerge, despite the seizures' surge, from the visual play of his dreams. What world does he vanish to? It seems impossible to draw in ink or words more than a sleeping child's curves and angles. When I tiptoe into his room to retuck his blanket, I'll only assume that wherever he's at, he'll come back. This is one I don't often read. I think this is part two of the book. So the first part is based on my son's epilepsy syndrome and the language issues that I experience as I learn about them. The second half of this book is based on something equally mysterious and unknowing as an epilepsy syndrome, which is my experience with recurrent miscarriage. And so there's that in this poem. So, plans. At age 3, I heard my mom's lessons for Sunday school, coloring Jesus, one idea. Come Sunday, time ran out. Later, Mom said, "But it was on the plan," I cried. When I learned to write, I printed daily menus. On puppy stationery, I scheduled hours of leisure, read, write to pen pals, walk dog, play with baby brother. In high school, I plotted dreams, college, marriage, house with garden, career, kids. Check, 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 except the last letter of the last one. Last winter, I graphed my garden in detail. Stenciled circles intersected, parallel lines perfect along blue cells. In summer, zucchini produced 20 long green limbs before too much rain caused root rot. Acorn squash gave 2 apple-sized specimens before it succumbed. I thought of them that September at my last DNC, 4th miscarriage, when the doctor scraped to hollow out, to leave empty and tender. How perfect plans look on paper, sketched in colored pencil, penned on glossy calendars. And still, I yearn to color Jesus, perhaps in the parable of the loaves and fishes, where he saw hunger and he saw need, and although it wasn't part of the plan, Jesus created something from nothing. No, something from love. Similar to Lee, I reached to stories and icons to work ideas and emotions mm-hmm. through, and at all my books, there's one, and this book, I turned to Wonder Woman because I had grown up watching the TV series, and so I took a lot of liberties with, there's the TV series, there's the movie, there's the comic, so, you know, strict aficionados can argue with me about it, but I kind of liberally used that icon in this poem and in the other poems in the book related to her, related to this one. So I like to imagine what she was doing when we didn't see her in those moments. Wonder Woman relaxes. Closing her steno pad at 5, Diana contemplates cuisine. Not the break room's lime jello. Superfood. Spinach sautéed in olive oil. Quinoa pilaf with Turkish apricots. Once home, glasses off, hair ponytailed, sweatpants on, she slices a pineapple like it's cream cheese. As she julienne's jalapenos, she needs no magic bracelet. Golden lassos won't quicken the task. She admires the cut's discernment. When her man's in trouble, Wonder Woman busts him out, slaps, slugs, strikes. What does it matter if she breaks a nail or 3? Her man doesn't see her. Post-mission, he's safe watching TV, and Diana's free to pummel villains with Superman, Aquaman. They love her feminine touch. Tonight, comics will wait. Skimming across the dusty wine rack, she chooses a cab, Opus 1, 85, and pulls out the company, creme brulee. On the balcony, she dines, the city's honks and calls her symphony. Sirens pulse through her veins like a heartbeat.
That's outgoing South Dakota State Poet Laureate Leanne Rorapaw alongside incoming State Poet Laureate Christine Stewart. Now, we know the arts can boost economies and build communities, but too often the systems to nourish those artistic communities simply don't exist. Laura Zabel is Executive Director for Springboard for the Arts. She was at Rural X on June 19th, and she joined us from Mitchell for a conversation about creative people power. Laura, thank you, and welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Let's talk about this report, because help people understand the big picture of what Creative People Power actually is as a project.
Yeah, so Creative People Power is our idea at Springboard that creative people are in every community, on every block, in every neighborhood, and that that's really a natural resource and a source of energy that our communities can tap into to the benefit of their economies and to the benefit of social connection and just building healthier, stronger, more vibrant communities. But to tap into that, we need to build some systems. So the good news is that every community already has creative people and creative thinkers. And then the challenge is that we have to figure out how to bring that creative thinking more fully into our community's systems and ways of working.
And sometimes the way this story is told is about an artist who does a big project or something that kind of catches people's imaginations a little bit, and they say, well, you know, could I do that in my community? But there's more to it than that, because you say sometimes focusing on one big project or one amazing superstar artist fails to set up the systems that can sort of make this sustainable. Tell us more about that.
Exactly.
Please.
I think we've all experienced really iconic and important, whether it's a piece of public art or a big artist project. And those can be really exciting and really inspirational, but sometimes they don't make us feel like, oh, I can do that in my own front yard, or I could take action in my own community. And so Springboard's work is really about how do we help everybody recognize their own creativity and everybody bring their creative ideas to the table, so that we're not just leaving it to a few people or something that happens in somebody else's community. So we're really interested in how more people can call themselves artists and more people can bring their creative ideas forward, and how we can really think about art as about meaning making in everyday life.
Meaning making. Well, that seems like something everybody would be interested in, right?
Exactly. I think it is sort of a fundamental human need and human right to make meaning out of our circumstances and in our communities. And it's one of the strongest ways, I think, particularly in rural communities, that we can help people tell the stories of the assets that exist in those communities already. I think right now there's a lot of stories being written outside of rural communities about the challenges and the needs of rural communities. And it's important, of course, to tell those stories, but there's also a lot of really strong and great and exciting and vibrant things happening in rural places. And we need to be able to lift those stories up and help people tell those stories if we're going to address some of those other challenges.
Let's talk about those systems and what your research bore out.
Yeah, so part of what our research says is that it's actually not that hard to tap into that creative people power, but you need some building blocks in your community. You need to have hubs and homes where people can bring creative ideas forward, where people can get connected. You need to support artists' ability to make a living and a life. So we think people should be able to have economic opportunity from making creative work in their communities. Artists should get paid is the shorthand way of saying that. And that there need to be systems that really seed lots of little projects. So rather than relying on that one big every once in a while project, how do you really make your community a place where people know they can get connected and try things out at a small scale, at a neighborhood scale? And maybe I could share an example of kind of a recent project of what that looks like in our work in Minnesota. In the West Central region of Minnesota, we recently worked with two artists named Anna Haglin and her partner, James Kleiner, to do a project that addressed the big issue of invasive species. And so they built a mobile papermaking studio where they take invasive plants and they pound them down into pulp. And then people in the community make paper from that pulp. And in that new paper they make, they plant native seeds. So you can take that piece of paper home and plant it in your yard and grow native seeds actually directly from paper that's made from invasive species. So we're like physically taking this invasive thing and turning it into something positive. And of course, it has a lot of other impacts too. By doing that, people are coming together, they're creating a shared experience, and the kind of metaphor of that process of turning something that is a big challenge in a community into something that could be an asset, I think, is kind of a microcosm of the way we think about the potential for creative people power in our communities.
Let's talk a little bit about this idea of hubs and homes, because as you mentioned that idea, I thought I've never heard of that before. That idea came from somebody who is, really looking out their own backyard. Elaborate a little bit on this concept of creating a space for people to bring those ideas and have them come out.
Mm-hmm. I think this is maybe our most critical need in rural communities, but also in urban neighborhoods have this need as well, that I think sometimes we think about art and culture as a thing we go do. You know, we go to a performance or we go to a gallery and it's a once in a while thing that we go visit rather than, you know, a place where the way we think about hubs and homes is a place where you can have a creative idea on your way home from work and stop by and say, hey, I've really noticed this need in my community. How do I get connected to other people who are working on this? Or I've been really struggling to think about where I could get some resources to try out this project with kids in my neighborhood or with folks from a new community that have just relocated here. How do we build connections here? And I think that kind of open place where people know that they can get connected up to resources, to other people, I think is a really important building block of building healthier communities and addressing some big challenges. And I think that can be a hub and home might be an organization like Springboard that has, you know, we in Fergus Falls, where our rural program is, we have a storefront in downtown Fergus that serves as that hub and home. But I think in other communities, it could be your public library or it could be a cafe or a person sometimes fills that role in a community for sure.
And how do you sort of, you know, if someone, you know, who is that person? Who is that librarian or that just, you know, everyday person, that cafe owner? And they're listening right now and they say, yeah, I'm that sounds good. Where do I begin? Mm-hmm. Where do you find the sort of ideas and the, as we talk, what I'm getting at here is as we talk about building systems, these people who are listening to this podcast across the state of South Dakota might say, is the system already exist? Do you have something I can tap into to figure out what to do next?
Yeah, we have a lot of building blocks and hopefully a lot of tools that that person listening can use. So Springboard runs a national platform called Creative Exchange. And on that platform are toolkits from projects that have happened all over the country that are sort of at this intersection of arts and community. And you can download any of those toolkits and get started on a project or bring people together to talk about what kind of project you might like to do in your own community. Those are resources that are just freely available. And that also represents a whole network of people doing this work all across the country that that can provide support and help and advice to get you connected. So yeah, to all those people who are out there listening and thinking about, hey, I might be that person or I know that person in my community or I know where that is. And if we just had a few more resources, if we just got a little more connected, maybe we could kind of accelerate this process. We could really bring some new thinking and some bigger creative ideas to our place, to our community or challenge some big problems that our community is addressing, then we have some tools to help with that. And we also want to learn from people who are doing that work already. That platform is as much about us sharing ideas as it is about helping other people share their ideas and kind of trying to build that network, really trying to build that ecosystem and system for creative people power across the whole country.
That's Laura Zabel, Executive Director of Springboard for the Arts in South Dakota for Rural X. A new South Dakota outdoor concert venue has launched its inaugural season. Levitt at the Falls is hosting 30 free public concerts this summer, with more on the way next year. And though people are coming from miles around, maybe you can't make it to Sioux Falls for a show. In the Moment has you covered. Season opener Ruthie Foster stopped by the studios for live music and conversation before she took the stage on June 14th. Hey, Ruthie, thanks for being here.
Hey, it's good to be here.
You have a really packed schedule. You just came back from Chicago where you were given another major award, and you've talked about the other places that you've been. I'm wondering, how do you find quiet on the road? Like, how does that fit into your creative process and the process of writing new songs?
That is a beautiful question. No one's ever asked me that. How do I find quiet? I steal it. No, I try. No, actually, I am quiet. I'm quiet in the van, and I'm usually when we check into our rooms, we get to where we need to be. I usually try to find, you know, some time to meditate and work out. And, you know, I try to take care of myself. And having quiet time is part of that in this business. Yeah.
Have you learned that the hard way? Or did you come in with that intention and stick to it?
I have learned it the hard way.
Yes.
A lot of years of doing this. And, it's just been, it's been a journey, really. Starting out, I think it was 96, I decided to do this full time after working in TV. And I was in the Navy for a while. And deciding to go full time after my mother passed, really to tell her story. You know, that's one of the reasons I wanted to go full time and do this, and tell my own story inside of that. Yeah. And now I'm in this place where my music's become my religion, if you will. You know, being up here and doing this is about therapy in so many ways. And hopefully having all those quiet moments and time to reflect and connect with communities around the world. Yeah, I can keep spreading the good news. I was trying to get, this is Josephine. She's a Michael Dan guitar. She's made by the made up in Quebec. And she's a little testy today, but I think she might want to do a little bit of Phenomenal Woman after talking about my mother and my grandmother. Yeah. Secret lies. I'm not cute, built a suit, a fashion model size. But when I start to tell them, they think I'm telling lies. Oh, it's in the reach of my arms, the span of my hips, the stride in my steps, the curve. Walk into a room just as cool as you please, and to a man the fellas stand and they fall down on their knees, and then they swarm around me like a hive of honeybees. Oh, it's in the fire in my eyes, the flash of my teeth, swing of my waist, the joy in my feet. I'm a woman, phenomenal woman. Oh, I'm a woman, yes I am. Yeah, baby, that's me. It's in the head's not bowed. I don't shout or jump about. I have to talk real loud. But when you see me passing, it ought to make you proud. Oh, it's in the click of my heels, the bend of my hair, the palm of my hands, the need for my care. 'Cause I'm a woman, phenomenal woman, yes. Oh, I'm a woman, yeah. Baby, that's me. Oh, that's me.
This is such a powerful piece from a Maya Angelou poem. Did she ever hear this song?
She did. Yeah. I didn't know that she had heard it. I did a show in Carrboro, North Carolina, where she was living at the time. And she sent flowers to my green room and sent me a beautiful note about being a phenomenal woman and passing this song as her poem, passing it on. Yeah.
That's a
I almost lost my mind. Yeah. It's flowers from Maya Angelou.
It's from the real, oh, wow. So you've brought poetry into your music. You've got you talked about the stories of your own life and your mother, and then you've done folk music and brought some new, fresh takes on some tunes that we've known since the 1960s.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about those stories of your own. Was there an artist that kind of gave you permission to do that? Was that something that you just sort of did naturally, that you said it's time to bring my own experience into my songwriting and my performing as well?
Another great question. Yeah, starting out for me, it was gospel music, and that was not just recorded music that I would hear in my house a lot. Maya Angelou, Mahalia Jackson, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, which is a lot to do with why I like these particular type of guitars, big, you know, curvy. And, you know, I listened to a lot of Phoebe Snow and Joan Armatrading, women. I listened to a lot of women songwriters. I've always loved big voices, so Mahalia Jackson was just right up there. It's Barbara Streisand. I studied a lot of Barbara Streisand throughout college just because she had this range and could sing anything, you know. But, you know, the women in my family were singers. My mother was a beautiful singer. My grandmother was, too. I grew up thinking that my mother was Aretha Franklin for a long time, you know. And music was just a huge part of our family. We sang in our church, and I traveled as a solo musician, pretty much representing my church all over Central Texas from 12 years old on to when I graduated high school.
So was it easy for you to step into those shoes, or did you have to overcome any kind of shyness or intimidation? Was it just inspiration because you kind of grew up in this soup of it, or was it you know, a little harder than that?
I was painfully shy. In fact, I had a pretty bad stutter from 12 to about 15, and my grandmother worked with me on that. I was just scared to speak, you know, and Big Mama, my grandmother, that's what we called her, she would work with me on Saturday evenings, so that I would have a poem, something to say. That's where the Maya Angelou poetry came in. At church on Sunday. So I had to open up with a poem every Sunday, you know, because of my Big Mama was helping me with my speaking. And really feeling comfortable about being in front of people, that came later as I told my own story through my music.
That's blues guitarist Ruthie Foster in the SDPB Sioux Falls studios. Along with poetry and music, South Dakotans have a passion for sculpture. Consider, if you will, Crazy Horse, Dignity, Mount Rushmore, the Ark of Dreams. Randy Berger is an artist and gallery owner in Hill City. He joined In the Moment to talk about sculpture in the hills, and he offered this reminder about our deeply personal relationship with art.
I believe art is energy. And for anybody to come in and take some energy from the art, as well as leave some energy of theirs, is a great way. And the experience of coming in and meeting people, and people aren't necessarily coming in looking for art. I think art finds them, if I could say that, you know. There's not a lot of people that are, they just find that energy of the art and like it, and it works. And some people, too, are building new homes, and one of my lines is always, buy your artwork first, and then you know where to put the windows.
If you think you are too far away from the artistic hubs of America to be artistically relevant, you might consider the words of one of America's contemporary creative voices. Kent Nerburn is author of Neither Wolf Nor Dog and author of Dancing with the Gods, which is a creative manifesto of sort. I asked him about art and failure, art and success, and whether or not art can come from right here in South Dakota.
Art is such a vulnerable process. If you're doing it right, you're bringing something out of yourself and you're putting it out before the world. And whether that be a character, the way you're interpreting a character, a piece of music you've written, a piece of music you're playing, a painting, a book. And when you get it out there, you want some level of approval. And different people have different levels of need. Some are perfectly happy just to have made something and say, well, I'm done, this is done. You know, and I know people who make the astonishing statement of, if they don't get it, it's their loss. Well, I can't make that statement, and I know too many who can. Instead, it's like, is this okay? Is this okay? And when someone rejects it or demeans it or just ignores it, all the fears of your own inadequacy, and the fear, the greatest fear of all is that you're a no talent and mediocre and a charlatan come washing in on you. It's very hard to handle criticism. It's very hard to handle lack of response from what's out there. Failure has its virtues. One thing about it is that you always can keep trying. You always can keep trying, and you say, well, that didn't work, this didn't work. It's a process of seeking out a voice. And so thinking as a sculptor, there's a sculpting away of the ephemera and the things that don't work. But it takes a lot of courage. I mean, rejection's hard. Rejection, I still don't like it. If I submit a proposal for a book and the person who's looking at it said, this doesn't make it, this sort of slogs, it bumps its tail, it doesn't take wing, there's a first sort of response of, well, you don't understand it. And the next one is, oh my God, I don't have it anymore. I think that you have to accept the fact that failure and rejection are part of the artistic experience. And so you just take it and you absorb it. You have to accept the fact also, and you have to take take solace in the fact that you've done something that other people don't do. You've created something from nothing. You have almost recapitulated the creative process of the universe. You have taken something from a germination point and brought it forth into the world. And you have to feel good about that. And that's a broad abstract issue. It's easier to feel good about something in an abstraction than it is to find that this thing has no voice and it has no life. But you just have to keep going. And, you know, I talked about it in terms of how I've been able to work in the Native community. Well, it also is how you work in the creative world. It's the bad cat syndrome. You just keep going back and back and back, and eventually you find a way in the door, and you find your voice. I always go back to the issue of voice. It's finding a voice, and that voice is something that comes from inside of you. When you find out that you are saying something that cannot be said any other way, or that you cannot say any better, then you say, yeah, I think I've got this. And then it's just courage. It's just, you know, not letting the wounds, the slings and arrows of outrageous misfortune get to you. But it's hard. Failure is a very hard thing.
Are there seeds in the projects that fail, the paragraphs that fail, the characters that fail? Is there almost always something in there that you find yourself coming back to in the future? Not necessarily that you saved the piece of paper that you typed this on and then you pulled out a line, but does that sort of live, in its own space, and then later you find it was reimagined in a different way?
Well, there is a clarification process that takes place. Once an idea is planted, it will grow in different fashions. But I have personally tried to take things that were on the cutting room floor and tried to fit them back into something that I was writing in a contemporary voice, contemporary situation, contemporary mind. And almost without exception, I found it to be a failure. I have one friend who says that, if you don't use it right away, throw it away. And I have another friend who said, put them all in a drawer, they have their purposes. And I think it does come down to temperament. I find that, again, it goes back to voice. If I've said it one time and I try to say it again the same way, then it loses its spontaneity. Things have an immediacy. And if they come out of you with a little sparkle, that you have to take that sparkle when it shows up. So I'm always filing impressions. I'm not filing necessarily particular sentences or pieces of work. I'm filing impressions. And you know the difference between when something comes naturally and is built upon everything that you've done before, and when something is forced. I talk in there about the time when I was a sculptor and I was working on a large sculpture for a monastery in British Columbia. And it was their patron saint was Joseph the Worker. And so I was doing this figurative version of Joseph the Worker, and I did the left arm, and I nailed it. It came out right away. And then I took the right arm, and I didn't get it right. And I niggled it and thought it and reworked it and, couldn't get the wrist right, couldn't get the relationship of the elbow and the forearm. It went from being gesture to posture. And I just, it lost any spontaneity that it had. And that was kind of a lesson to me. If it isn't alive immediately, or even if it is alive immediately, it probably has only that moment. And the sad thing is when something is really alive, but it doesn't have any place in what you're doing. You say, this is great, and if anyone ever wanted to bother to look in my drawer, my computer screen 20 years or 30 years from now, they would say, what is all this stuff? I mean, if you piled it up, it's this tall. And you know what? I'll bet there's some really, really good stuff in there, but I don't know if it'll ever find its way out. It hasn't worked to me to be an archaeologist of my own work. Mm-hmm. It only works if it's got a little freshness. And that's why I'm having fun on this tour and writing and blogging, because it's like, I'm alive, I'm doing it. Yeah. And there is sort of a Lazarus thing. You're trying to bring something back from the dead once it's been put away. At least that's the way it works for me. And so I've just had to accept the fact that, as they say, you kill your babies. And sometimes, And I got some dead babies, which is a macabre phrase, but hey,
right.
People in the arts know about that. We've all got dead babies out there, so.
In some ways, that circles us back to the idea of trust and trusting that there are more ideas forward than there are back, and that it's okay to take that step forward and release the things that just didn't work.
And that's why
there'll be more.
And that's why it comes back to the question of where do you get fed? Where do you get your inspiration? What is it that that's drawing you? I mentioned in the book about like Georgia O'Keeffe moved to the Southwest and switched from sculpture, or switched to sculpture because her eyesight wasn't doing well. Which of the Impressionist painters
Monet. Yeah.
Right. Thank you. I think it was cataracts he had or something, and it changed his vision. So suddenly he could see differently. He could see better. And so new information was coming to him from the outside world that he wouldn't have had before. In my case, if I'm looking at people, I see people differently than I did 20 or 30 years ago. I look at young people differently. I look at old people differently. So there's constantly new information, but you got to go out and get the new information. You can't sit there and say, learn your own lesson here, Kent, by the way. You can't sit there and say, got this big pile of stuff and there's good stuff in it. No, there's a big pile of stuff out in the world and you better go out and try to find that because you want your work to have life. And if it isn't going to have life if it's essentially an excavation of your past.
Right. Will you read for us from Dancing with the Gods?
Yeah, this is just a little section at the end where... It'll take about a minute here if we have. Do we have that?
Yes, yeah. We do. Thank you.
This is the last, the coda, the last chapter. I've spoken much, perhaps too much, about the difficulties and challenges of a life in the arts. But I've done so for a reason. I know too well the heaviness of the burden and the elusive nature of the dream. And I want to let you know that I understand and that you are not alone. But I hope I have spoken too of the joys and the magic of this life and have given you a vision of the world that awaits you when you give yourself to it. It is a life unlike any other, and those of you who choose it are privileged to live inside this rare and magical realm. Still, the life of the artist is not easy. The world will not understand you. It will praise you too much and respect you too little. It will see the grace that you have struggled so hard to achieve in your work and assume that it came easily, or as the result of a God-given talent. It will assume that you are indifferent to the worldly concerns of finances and economic survival and think that the satisfaction of living a creative life is compensation enough. It will look upon you with envy because you get to live the life of the creator and regard you with jealousy because you appear to avoid the dross of an ordinary life. It will distort you in ways you cannot imagine. Can I read a bit more? A little more here.
Yes.
All right. Though these difficulties will weigh on you, they are a small price to pay for the gifts you have been given. You have learned to see the world with mindfulness because in the life of an artist, no moment is insignificant. You have been kept from cynicism because you know that work based on cynicism is heartless and callow. You have known the gift of conversing with people from different times and different lands because art is a language of the heart and the heart is universal. Most of all, you have been given the gift of endless youth because your life is based upon curiosity. And the curious never get old.
I love that. You have not lived an ordinary life, but you have embraced the ordinary in many ways.
Well, I love the ordinary. It's the lifeblood of our time on Earth. And we're all just here trying to pay our rent for the time we're here. And to me, it's a celebration of the ordinary. It's ceremonies of the ordinary. So.
Do we need art?
Oh, absolutely. We need to know that there is a way of framing this world outside of us with a creative vision. And art is an act of mindfulness. It's an act of mindfulness to create. It's an act of mindfulness to perceive. If you read a poet, if you listen to a musician, you're hearing something that transcends our ordinary and our everyday. And you're also, the artist has the capacity to touch someone in a place where they might feel alone. It gives us a reason to say, we are better than the world that we live in. we have some dreams. It's the world of the dreamer, you know, and that's what I like to say, the artists are the tribe of the endless dreamers. And to put dreams out there in physical form is just a wonderful experience. And, you know, you could say in some ways, you know, as Rodney Dangerfield would say, it ain't easy being me. But in other ways, there's no better way to live, because you are, you're giving dreams external form, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
Can art in our remaining minute come from anywhere? Can it come from here, from this place, from South Dakota, from Pine Ridge, from any of the places that you stopped at? Can art that is as every bit as significant to the world come from here as it can from a major coastal city, for example?
I think more significant art comes from here, because this is an authentic life. Art too often in urban centers becomes self-referential. It's artists making commentaries on other art. It's writers looking over their shoulder at what other writers are doing. It's in economic hotbeds where people are struggling. They have to be successful. Here, people create because they have something to say. And the challenge is having something to say and finding out that you can say it well. And to me, the best art comes from the big empty spaces and the quiet spaces, because art is an act of quiet, and this is a land of quiet and big skies. So I think this is a great place to create art.
That's author Kent Nerburn on In the Moment. You can listen to the full conversation online at listen.sdpb.org. The In the Moment Arts and Entertainment podcast is produced by SDPB's Josh Heyer. You can connect with us on Instagram, SDPB In the Moment, and follow us on Twitter at @MomentSDPB. For In the Moment producers Steve Zwemke, Chris Loffrey, and Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Keep creating, and thank you for listening.